the National Archives podcast series, Titanic, Emigrant Ship or Luxury Liner, read by Roger Kershaw.
Titanic, Emigrant Ship or Luxury Liner. Aidan Laws joined the Public Record Office as an assistant keeper in 1989, was responsible for the museum. Then head of publishing and head of outreach and collection development. His document facsimile pack, Titanic, The Official Story, became one of TNA's best-selling products. Sadly, Aidan passed away on the 1st of April 2012, but as a tribute to all the work he contributed to Titanic, it was felt only fitting to include the paper he was due to give at the conference on the 14th of April 2012. This talk has two themes: history as a story, constantly reinterpreted for new audiences, and one neglected aspect of the Titanic story appropriate to an age of globalization, her role as an emigrant ship. History is always easier to digest and to deliver as a cliche. Shared assumptions between narrator and audience allow for transmission without qualifications that might distract from the main thrust of the drama. The sinking of the Titanic has always provided a dramatic backdrop for stories told in different ways for different audiences, particularly in film, the medium through which many consume historical events. Witnesses of what actually happened saw different things from different angles. The director will pick and choose for dramatic effect to create his own illusion of coherent narrative. Titanic film director James Cameron once described history itself as a sort of consensus hallucination, perhaps more accurate as a description of the filmmaker's art. Life is more complex. It can be difficult for even the leading players in a major hit event to say definitely what took place. As the Duke of Wellington said of Waterloo, the history of a battle is not unlike the history of a ball. Some individuals may recollect all the little events of which the great result is the battle won or lost, but no individual can recollect the order in which, or the exact moment at which, they occurred. In 1953, surviving third-class passenger Bridget Bradley was taken to see the latest, now largely forgotten, Titanic film starring Barbara Stanwyck. Her daughter recalls in her biography, Unsinkable Bridget, "She became very emotional during the movie and at times kept shaking her head as if to say, no, it didn't happen that way." From the start, the press fed a public hunger for visual images of what had happened in the last hours of the Titanic using posed actors. Fact and fiction were confused. Some contemporary newsreels showed film of her sister ship, Olympic, as the Titanic. You can see a clip of genuine Gaumont newsreel film on the British Pathé website. Actress Dorothy Gibson co-wrote and starred in Saved from the Titanic, released barely a month after the sinking, wearing the same clothes she had worn in the lifeboat, cardigan and polo coat over white silk evening dress. The now lost 10-minute film concerned, like so many of its successors, thwarted romance. It was released in Britain under the title A Survivor of the Titanic. At 35 minutes, the German production In Nacht und Eis, In Night and Ice, was three times longer than the average 1912 film and can be seen on YouTube. In 1930, the general manager of the White Star Line was horrified by the release of the film Atlantic, now also on YouTube. He complained it would damage British shipping interests. A British film produced with British capital in Great Britain. It does seem extremely unfortunate that our own nationals should think it well to get out a picture of this character. If this had been done by an enemy, it would have been understood. Actually, an Anglo-German production, the Bayerische Staatszeitung's review, commented on German steamers, a Titanic catastrophe would have been impossible. In 1938, the British shipping industry again opposed the making of another Titanic film, this time by Alfred Hitchcock. Their letter refers to the killing of a film on the SS Morro Castle. This American liner had been ravaged by the fire in September 1934, killing 137 passengers and crew. The Nazi film Titanic, made in 1943, was a story of British cowardice and incompetence, an eternal condemnation of England's quest for profit, and remained in circulation after the war. A Night to Remember, made in 1958, its very title classic British understatement, rescued the situation with Kenneth Moore. A portrayal of the essence of British character as one of unchanging steadfastness and decent virtue, it offered an antidote to a decade in which old certainties about Britain's role had been challenged in post-war world, notably Suez, and the country had seemed to lose its way. You can listen to Joseph Boxall, Titanic's fourth officer, who was the film's technical advisor, talking in 1962 at bbc.co.uk/archive/Titanic. James Cameron's dynamic Titanic in 1997 promotes the traditional vision of the United States as a youthful land of opportunity where anyone can make it, and class barriers of the old Europe are there to be vaulted over. All these films can teach us something about the period when they were made. None can capture the totality of the reality. The easiest cliche of all in the Titanic story, embedded by film in the popular imagination, is to see her just as a luxury liner, a lavish floating hotel for the rich, sacrificing higher bulkheads or more lifeboats on deck to the need to have a grander staircase and more promenading space. All too often, the whole Edwardian era, from the death of Victoria to the outbreak of the Great War, is viewed almost exclusively in terms of the life of the upper classes, a golden age, the Indian summer before Armageddon. Official documentation shows Titanic classified by the British Board of Trade not as a passenger liner, but as an emigrant ship. That is, a British or foreign ship which carries in any voyage from the British Isles to any port out of Europe, and not within the Mediterranean Sea, more than 50 steerage passengers. The term emigrant ship was, however, one more appropriate to early 19th century transatlantic crossings. By 1912, migration travelling both ways was well established. Between 1870 and 1914, tens of millions of Europeans and others crossed and recrossed international borders and sailed the North and South Atlantic, often many times. The cumulative picture of movement is one of a swarming or churning of people back and forth across the Atlantic highway, fed by growing railway networks on either side of it. This is a quote from the Great Transatlantic Migrations 1870 to 1914 by Walter Nugent in 1992. The report of survey of an emigrant ship for Titanic in the National Archives documents MT9/92, dated 12th of April 1912 and signed off by official William Tiller, was discussed in detail by the Solicitor General at the British Commission of Inquiry, anxious to prove that all the statutory regulations had been adhered to. Number 5 is the important one. I've inspected the boats and their equipments and have seen 16 swung out and lowered into the water. The life belts are in order and are conveniently placed. The distress signals and their magazine and the other equipments comply with the regulations and are to my satisfaction. In other words, the requirements under the Merchant Shipping Acts have been complied with. At each port of departure, a certificate for clearance had to be issued by an emigration officer. The inquiry commissioner, Lord Mercy, asked, "Is this the principle upon which they go, that where you have an emigrant ship, it is impossible to provide sufficient boats for all the people on board, if you are to have proper regard for the stability of the ship and the working of the ship?" The Attorney General replied that this was so, whereas cargo boat regulations required lifeboats for all on board because fewer passengers were on board. Mercy commented, "So far as the lifeboats are concerned, a man is safer upon a cargo ship than upon an emigrant ship," but accepted the principle lest more elaborate safety provision prejudice financial viability. Today we take safety first for granted. this was not the case a century ago. The commissioner argued, you must have regard to the ship as a commercial venture, otherwise a ship would never go to sea at all. If you are to think only of the lives of the people on board and nothing else, you might have such a complicated system of life-saving apparatus that the ship could never sail. Emigrant ship status also affected the ship's design. Edward Wilding of Harland and Wolff testified, a particular requirement of the American immigration laws that has to be complied with is the question of area provided for each third class passenger, each immigrant into the United States. That is considerably in excess, something like 20% in excess of the British Board of Trade requirements for emigrant passengers. Emigrant ships were much more closely regulated than passenger liners. The Attorney General noted, it was thought that passengers could look after themselves and emigrants could not. Mersey agreed. That is exactly the truth. Emigrants are, very properly, treated as if they were children or sick people, and they have to be looked after. Immigrants and steerage passengers were subject to medical inspections before boarding and, again, before they were permitted entry to the United States. Standing in line for examination is something we are all familiar with from airport security procedures. The sheep-like mentality that can result from being treated like children or sick people by officials may help to account for how many third-class passengers reacted in their last hours on the vessel. Throughout the journey, they had been conditioned to await instructions from authority, but this was a situation in which authority did not know what to do. Made 5 years after Titanic sank, Chaplin's film The Immigrant shows steerage passengers being herded and bullied by officials, one of whom gives Charlie a kick in the rear. Who were those who were described in such patronising terms? It is easy to assume those travelling steerage were ipso facto emigrants. Mersey claimed it would be impossible to distinguish among the third class between emigrants and people who were not emigrants. You must treat them all as emigrants. This is rather a lazy assumption to make. If by emigrant we just mean someone with a predetermined intention to settle permanently in another country. The reality was more complex. Of the children who were travelling in steerage, 65% were lost. Most of those in first or second class were saved. This aroused much angry criticism at the time. Union leader Ben Tillett condemned the vicious class antagonism shown in the practical forbidding of the saving of the lives of the third class passengers. Officials drafting a response to a parliamentary question, why the majority of children in steerage were drowned, resolved the president of the Board of Trade, the responsible minister, should say as little as possible, commenting, it seems a pity to put questions of this kind. Sir Alfred Chalmers, the Board of Trade's nautical expert, continued to argue that more lifeboats would not have made a difference. The Goodwin family provide a poignant case study. A general labourer in the 1911 census, Frederick Goodwin lived in Melksham in Wiltshire with his wife Augusta and six children. Eldest girl, 15-year-old Lillian, works as a nursemaid, and Charles and William, still at school, as delivery boys. Jesse, aged 11, and Harold, aged 9, go to school. Six-month-old baby Sydney is not shown. His body was only identified by DNA analysis in 2006. The whole family drowned when the Titanic sank. Goodwin had been a printer and compositor in 1901. Clearly, the family's economic position had worsened. If he now depended on seasonal work as a general labourer, their income could have been irregular and low, perhaps a similar standard of living to the families described in Maud Pember Reeve's 1913 Lambeth survey, round about a pound a week. His brother Thomas lived in New York and suggested Frederick come over to work in a new electric power station, regular employment in a booming industry in the land of opportunity. Ironically, it was a coal strike, symptom of deepening social dissatisfaction at home, that led to the cancellation of other sailings and, with a number of other third-class passengers, this family's transfer to the Titanic. The official report of the 1911 census shows a huge surge in emigration between 1901 and 1911. Was this due to a worsening economic situation at home? Burke Pickard, one of the few third-class passengers to be interviewed by the more wide-ranging American Commission of Inquiry, gave his address as the Hebrew Immigrant Society in New York, a charity that had been established in 1881. He testified, "At the time I took passage on the Titanic, I came from London, I am 32 years old, I am a leather worker, a bag maker. I was born in Russia, in Warsaw. My name was Burke Trembinsky. I was for a long time in France and I assumed a French name. As regards private business, I am Pickard." Anti-Jewish riots in Eastern Europe, encouraged by official anti-Semitism, had stimulated large-scale emigration. Some 2.7 million Jews migrated west between 1881 and 1914. Many sought employment or a better standard of living. Others wanted to avoid compulsory military service or persecution. Some settled in the United Kingdom. Although in the early 20th century, East European immigration generated even more political controversy than it does today and led to a Restrictive Aliens Act in 1905. Others went to South Africa or crossed the Atlantic. Individuals like Pickard can be difficult to track in the days before passport controls. Informal changes of name can make the task practically impossible. Changing names when buying an onward ticket was not uncommon to evade cheap ticket restrictions that required 6 weeks' residence before travelling on. Official records can't always be taken at face value. False names were used by others on the Titanic, including the Navratil family, being taken away by their father without the permission of his estranged wife. George Rosenshine using the name Thorne to share a cabin with his mistress Mabel Thorne, and Swedish socialist August Andersson travelling under the name of Wennerström. Some in third class were experienced travellers. Norwegian Olaus Abelseth was returning to America with his brother-in-law, cousin, another man from his hometown, and two teenage Norwegian girls they had been asked to look after. Originally a sailor and casual labourer, he had first gone to America with his brother around 1903 and eventually bought a farm in Dakota, returning to Norway in 1911. Asked several times at the US inquiry if steerage passengers had been held back by restraint or locked gates, Abel simply replied, "Not that I could see." Neither official inquiry interviewed any women who had been travelling third class. These often travelled with men from the same vicinity who had been asked to look after them. Of the small group from King Williamstown, now Ballydesmond in County Cork, Ireland, the only male to survive was Daniel Buckley, a farm labourer. He told the US inquiry, "I wanted to come over here to make some money with three boys that came from the same place in Ireland." He tells of a crewman holding back steerage passengers, one of whom broke the lock on a gate. "They tried to keep us down at first, on our steerage deck. They did not want us to go up to the first class place at all. Some clearly thought they would be safer on the huge ship than in tiny lifeboats. There was a girl from my place, and just when she got down into the lifeboat, she thought the boat was sinking into the water. Her name was Bridget Bradley. She climbed one of the ropes as far as she could and tried to get back into the Titanic again, as she thought she would be safer in it than in the lifeboat. She was just getting up when one of the sailors went out to her and pulled her down again." Burke Pickard also said, "I was sorry at not being on the ship, and I said to the seaman, I would rather be on the ship." Also travelling with Daniel and Bridget were Hannah Reardon, aged 18, and Nora O'Leary, aged 16. Nora O'Leary, born in 1895, was the daughter of a farmer and was to visit her sister Katie in New York. Initially, she stayed on as a domestic servant, but later returned to Ireland, married, and was buried in Ballydesmond. Her travelling companion stayed. Hannah Reardon also visited her sister in New York, married there, and became a naturalised United States citizen. Bridget Bradley eventually moved to Ontario after marrying a Canadian. By 1912, the passage of Irish girls like these, many working as domestic servants backwards and forwards across the Atlantic, was well established. In the decade from 1901 through to 1910, 55% of Irish transatlantic migrants were female, a much higher proportion than other European countries such as Britain, where it was 38%, and Italy, where it was 33%. Robert Kennedy has argued that there is an unusually severe degree of male dominance in Ireland, and the status of young single women in Ireland was worsening. Better job opportunities in America, in shops, schools and offices, as well as traditional domestic service, were a powerful draw. Just how commonplace migration was is revealed by an incident 5 years previous. In September 1907, New York was convulsed with a newspaper story about 1,000 single women arriving on the White Star liner SS Baltic in search of husbands. Young farmers from Michigan flocked to the city to be told by immigration officials that there were many young women on the boat who were not looking for husbands and whose wishes in the matter have to be respected. White Star officials insisted it was artificial press gossip. In reality, such traffic was normal. The round trip only costs in the third class $65. The girls are earning in New York $20 to $25 a month. I know several who receive $40 and they like to run home for a trip when their employees have gone to Europe themselves or are in the country. Women travelling alone in steerage might be detained on arrival as the authorities wanted to be sure that someone would look after them. This list shows many Irish girls and the disposition column, which names the relatives they were to stay with. It's often stamped Father Henry instead. He was the director of the Mission of Our Lady of the Rosary for the protection of Irish immigrant girls, which helped those arriving in New York without friends or relatives. In 1908, it claimed that it had assisted nearly one third of the 307,823 Irish girls who had passed through the port of New York since its establishment in 1883. Finally, in the graveyard of the Bulgarian Orthodox Church of Gumunchnik near Troyan in central Bulgaria, stands a monument to 8 villagers who drowned when the Titanic sank. They had been travelling together to the booming city of Chicago, lured by local agents who promoted the journey with posters proclaiming, "Discover the planet's new world," and "Happiness was only in America." Wages there could be 2 to 4 times higher than in Europe, with the cost of living the same or less. Selling tickets to America with a promise of jobs could be a profitable business, although under US law, technically, it was illegal for steamship company agents to solicit, invite, or encourage the immigration of any aliens into the United States. Many were migrant labourers, wishing to send money home and eventually return. They could end up being exploited by middlemen and gangmasters, a hidden traffic in humanity that persists today. Aged between 36 and 19, little is known beyond their names. Each had paid £7.17.11 for through tickets to Chicago. Perhaps the older men had families. Titanic steerage passengers were not simply emigrants, very properly treated as if they were children or sick people. These ordinary people striving to make their way in the world deserve more than simply being extras in crowd scenes. Look behind the drama and the clichés to see them, and those who cross the seas today in search of a better life for themselves and their families with the individual dignity they deserve.
This podcast was recorded in April 2012 at the National Archives, Kew. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.